Critical Review, The People versus Leo Frank, 2009, directed by Ben Loderman and senior consultant Steve Oney, PBS, broadcast November 2, 2009, runtime approximately 85 minutes, author Nathan Green, editor Sal Stevens. Why, overview, and the opening frame. The People vs. Leo Frank opens with a black screen bearing a single title card, made possible by the National Endowment for the Humanities. That card is important. It signals to viewers that what follows is a work of public educational programming, produced with federal funds, subject to standards of historical accuracy and editorial independence. Yet viewers who trust that signal are owed a more complete picture of how the film was actually made and who shaped its conclusions. The film is an approximately 85-minute docudrama combining dramatic reenactments with commentary from historians, legal figures, and descendants of the principals. It was written and directed by Ben Loderman, whose prior documentary work appeared on Frontline and American Experience. Steve Oney, author of the 2003 volume And the Dead Shall Rise, The Murder of Mary Fagan, and The Lynching of Leo Frank, served as chief consultant. Oney is unabashedly a pro-Frank activist and has stated that he is 95% sure Leo Frank is innocent and Jim Conley is alone the culprit. Additional commentary came from historian Leonard Dinnerstein, former Georgia Governor Roy Barnes, and playwright Alfred Ury, who are all openly pro-Frank activists. The film's thesis and advocacy mission is not subtle or nuanced. Before a single frame of footage aired, the Associated Press described the film in its promotional wire copy as a century-old miscarriage of justice that still haunts anyone who knows of it. An educational docudrama, as The People of Leo Frank, 2009, has been called by some of its advocates and supporters, built on a predetermined verdict, is an advocacy film, not an objective documentary. The question this review addresses is not whether The People vs. Leo Frank reaches a conclusion, since all documentary films typically do, but whether it earns that conclusion honestly through the available primary source record, or whether it produces that conclusion by suppressing evidence that contradicts it. 2. The funding problem and the ADL connection. The National Endowment for the Humanities credit on the opening frame tells only part of the funding story. The film was underwritten in part by $500,000 raised from Georgians, predominantly members of Atlanta's well-organized Jewish community, as well as Cobb County figures, including former Governor Roy Barnes and Marietta Daily Journal publisher Otis Brumby. Premiere tickets were distributed through the Anti-Defamation League's network of allies. The ADL is not a neutral historical organization. It is regarded as one of the world's most prominent Jewish advocacy organizations that has spent decades pressing for the posthumous exoneration of Leo Frank as a cause central to its institutional identity. ADL was the leading petitioner, along with the American Jewish Committee, B'nai B'rith, and the Atlanta Jewish Federation, seeking to get Leo Frank officially declared innocent by the state of Georgia. It has lobbied the Georgia legislature, supported the Fulton County Conviction Integrity Unit Review, founded on April 26, 2019, and funded research and media favorable to the Frank Innocence Project and narrative. The ADL was founded in September of 1913, galvanized in direct response to the August 25, 1913 homicide conviction of Leo Frank, and it was the lead organization in getting Frank posthumously half-pardoned in 1986, though it failed to achieve exculpation of the deceased convict. An organization that has publicly and institutionally committed to one conclusion in an ethnically contested historical case, funded a documentary about that case, and distributed its premiere tickets. No fair-minded viewer or curious truth-seeker could mistake these credentials for the lineaments of impartiality. This is a textbook conflict of interest. Documentary journalism and public broadcasting carry professional standards requiring disclosure of funder relationships that could compromise editorial independence. The film's opening credits do not disclose the ADL's deep involvement. The USNEH imprimatur lends the film an appearance of federally validated objectivity that the actual funding picture does not support. DVD extras distributed with the film to public schools include a teacher's guide developed by the Anti-Defamation League. The ADL thus shaped not only the film's financing and distribution, but also the educational materials designed to guide how students interpret the docudrama in classrooms across the country. 3. The framing architecture, ambiguity as rhetorical strategy. The film's approach to contested evidence is instructive. Rather than engaging disputed claims directly and resolving them against the primary source record, the film consistently presents evidence in terms calibrated to produce doubt in both directions. While its expert commentary, provided almost exclusively by journalists, historians, professors, and scholars who advocate Frank's innocence, supplies the interpretive lens steering viewers toward the predetermined conclusion that Leo Frank's guilty verdict wasn't cut and dried. The film doesn't dare mention the Georgia Supreme Court upheld the evidence at the Leo Frank trial as being sufficient for a conviction. Instead, the trial is presented as inconclusive. Only a minority of dissenting voices to the predominant pro-defense narrative is given some tokenism, so that the lopsided effect of the film isn't 100% biased, but somewhere closer to 95%. Director Loderman selected for the dramatization Jim Conley's own lawyer, William Smith, as the fictionalized film's hero and narrator, an idealist who gradually realizes his client is not an innocent dupe, but a masterful liar and cold-blooded murderer. This structural choice is not neutral. By selecting a character whose dramatic arc ends in moral conviction of Conley, the film ensures its narrative engine runs toward ensuring the viewer is tilted into believing in Conley's guilt. The dramatic question is never genuinely open. Conley is portrayed by historians Carter and Dinnerstein as a kind of mesmerizing storyteller and perhaps a diabolical genius that tricked the entire white-dominated legal system, thus leaving us to believe it was Leo Frank who was duped all along. This oversimplification never goes into the specific physical evidence and witness testimony, including the defendant's admission, that indicated Leo Frank's guilt to be a near mathematical certainty. Even the letterboxed consensus among general viewers acknowledged the film's directional tilt. One reviewer noted the contradictions in the evidence and police conduct are shown mostly from a point of view favoring Frank. The expert commentary reinforces this clandestine narrative. Dinnerstein, Oney, and Urey supply the analytical framework. All three are on record as believing Frank was wrongly convicted. No comparable voice representing the contrary evidentiary position is given sustained time. Mary Fagan Keene, great-niece and namesake of the victim, was actively recruited for an interview, but any of her discussion of the trial evidence was fully edited out. The film's producer wrote that Fagan Keene and she alone could bring the authentic voice and perspective of the Fagan family to the documentary. A film that claims to represent the full record of a contested case, having actively sought and failed to obtain the most prominent evidentiary voice on the opposing side, is not a balanced inquiry. Only Fagan Keene's non-trial commentary was spliced into the discussion section. 4. Mark Cohen's critique, The Confession, The Film Suppressed. The most analytically rigorous criticism of The People versus Leo Frank appears in Mark Cohen's September 2012 article, Did Leo Frank Confess?, published in the American Mercury on the 99th anniversary of the guilty verdict. Cohen argues that at the climax of the Frank trial, an admission was made by the defendant that was tantamount to a confession during trial, even if Leo Frank never openly confessed. It was Frank's incriminating statement on the witness stand that sustained the prosecution's case, full stop. When Leo Frank mounted the witness stand on Monday afternoon, August 18, 1913, at 2:15 p.m., he orally delivered an unsworn, four-hour, pre-written statement. Nestled within that statement was an admission of his presence in the death room at the critical moment. Cohen's analysis identifies three separate tantamount confessions embedded in the primary record. The official record shows Leo Frank confessed to murdering Mary Fagan three times, though he would deny all three. Confession number one was made to Jim Conley on the day of the murder, when Frank told him he had tried to be with the Fagan girl and she refused him, then stated he had hit her, and said, "I guess I struck her too hard and she fell and hit her head against something." Conley's testimony, brief of evidence, Aug 4, 6, 1913. Some of Mary Fagan's bloody hair was found on April 28, 1913, on the handle of a lathe in the second floor metal room, directly consistent with this account. Leo reportedly confessed the murder to his wife Lucille, if we are to believe the affidavit, State Exhibit J of Manola McKnight, brief of evidence. The trial statement itself compounded the problem. Frank spent some 3 hours of his four-hour unsworn testimony painstakingly detailing his accounting work, something barely relevant to the charges against him. He then proceeded, in what amounted almost to a confession of murder, to state that he might have unconsciously gone to the bathroom, right next to where blood was found and where Jim Conley testified he found the freshly killed corpse of Mary Fagan, and at exactly the same time that the child was theorized to have been killed. Frank's exact words were, To the best of my recollection, I didn't stir out of the office, but it's possible that, in order to answer a call of nature, I may have gone to the toilet. These are things that a man does unconsciously and can't tell how many times nor when he does it. A Rotten Tomatoes reviewer asked directly why Ben Loderman left out of the docudrama the incriminating admission Leo Frank made at his trial on August 18, 1913, that amounted to a murder trial confession. Cohen's article answers that question by documenting what the admission contained and why suppressing it was essential to the film's thesis. Note, the tantamount confession wasn't actually a confession in the literal sense, but as close as one could get to one without openly admitting the crime. Frank reversed his own alibi and supported the prosecutor's theory of where the murder took place. Cohen further notes that certainty of Frank's guilt was so strong that after reviewing his trial testimony for months, and after the Georgia Supreme Court's majority decision upheld Frank's conviction and the fairness of his trial, Judge Benjamin Hill on March 7, 1914, sentenced him to die on his 30th birthday, April 17, 1914. Cohen argues that only certainty of guilt warrants such a deliberately cruel sentencing date by a judge. The film The People vs. Leo Frank does not address any of this trial testimony. Cohen's article represents the most detailed engagement with the specific August 18th trial statement available in the secondary literature and stands as the most pointed single-source refutation of the film's treatment of Frank's courtroom testimony. V. What the film omits, the physical evidence record. The most consequential failures of the people, vs. Leo Frank, are not argumentative. They are evidentiary. Reviewers who compared the film against the Leo Frank trial brief of evidence, 1913, and the Atlanta newspapers of record documented the following systematic omissions. The metal room forensic evidence. The film failed to mention the 5-inch-wide bloodstain found on the metal room floor adjacent to the men's bathroom entryway, discovered by Magnolia Kennedy, and the hair with dried blood found tangled around the solid iron handle of Robert P. Barrett's lathe workstation in the metal room, found early Monday morning, April 28, 1913. This evidence establishes that the assault on Mary Fagan most likely occurred on the second floor, not in the basement where her body was found and likely placed to confuse the origin of the crime that happened in a room opposite to Frank's office. Omitting it from an 85-minute documentary examining where and how she died is not an oversight. It removes the geographic logic of the prosecution's case entirely. Frank's accusations against black workers. The film leaves out that Frank blamed not one but two black workers, repeatedly using a racial slur in doing so, not to mention his defense attorneys engaged in the same behavior during the trial. The film foregrounds race and ethnicity as an explanatory framework throughout, arguing a northern Jewish man was convicted in part because convicting a black man would have been socially inconvenient, Van Perlberg's assertion in the commentary within the film. That argument cannot be made honestly while suppressing the fact that Frank himself loudly and repeatedly pointed at black workers as the perpetrators. The film conveniently leaves that part out. The physicians dragging evidence. Physicians noticed that the scratch marks on Mary Fagan's face, she had been dragged face down in the basement, did not bleed, strongly suggesting she was already dead when the dragging took place. The defense theory that Conley assaulted her alive in the basement collapses against this forensic finding. The film does not address it. The 13 appeals. Frank's conviction was reviewed and upheld across 13 separate tribunals, including the United States Supreme Court in Frank v. Mangum, 1915. The film deserves the grade of atrocious partisan propaganda for historical accuracy when compared against the 3 Atlanta daily newspaper accounts, The Brief of Evidence, 1913, and the Leo Frank Georgia Supreme Court records, 1913 and 1914. 6. The Oney Paradox. The film's chief consultant created the film's central intellectual problem. Steve Oney spent more than 15 years writing in The Dead Shall Rise, published in 2003. 1 year later, in a February 2004 interview with the Jewish Journal, Oney explicitly repudiated the anti-Semitic mob chant claim, the allegation that crowds shouted anti-Semitic threats at jurors during the trial. He stated, "It didn't happen. It was something that someone wrote a couple of years after the crime, and then it got stuck into subsequent recounting of the story. Jews were accepted in the city, and the record does not substantiate subsequent reports that the crowd outside the courtroom shouted at the jurors, 'Hang the Jew, or we'll hang you.'" Crucially, even Oney's own 2013 Atlanta Magazine piece confirmed this finding. He wrote that there is no evidence for the later claim that crowds shouted at the jury, "Hang the Jew or we'll hang you," calling it an invention by Frank's supporters and indicative of the heavy-handedness that would mark their pronouncements. Oney served as chief consultant on a film produced over 2008 and 2009, 4 and 5 years after the Jewish Journal interview, and the Atlanta Magazine piece later confirmed his position had not changed. The film nonetheless frames Frank's prosecution within an undercurrent of the anti-Semitic climate narrative. Oney's own documented finding that the evidentiary record does not support the mob chant claim now sits in public retellings, an irresolvable tension with the film's contextual framework that has Frank's coreligionists hovering inside and out of its structure. Mark Cohen also reviewed Oney's and the Dead Shall Rise directly for the American Mercury, finding that Oney shamelessly fails to inform the reader of who ultimately solved the Mary Fagan murder mystery in 1913. 7. Leonard Dinnerstein and the Secondary Literature Problem. Leonard Dinnerstein's 1968 book, The Leo Frank Case, is the foundational secondary source for the innocence narrative and the tale that anti-Semitism was the undercurrent. Dinnerstein appears in the film as an authoritative voice. His framing of the case is presented without systematic challenge from the primary record. Dinnerstein engages in much academic fraud in the documentary, especially with regard to how the police found out Jim Conley could read and write. It was actually a pawn shop owner that tipped off detectives, not Leo Frank. Mary Fagan bite wound hoax outside the film's retelling. Both Dinnerstein and Oney promoted the Leo Frank bite mark theory in their books. That theory originates with Pierre Van Passen's 1964 memoir, a source that does not constitute primary evidence under any archival or legal evidentiary standard. Though this bite wound hoax is not mentioned in the documentary, it shows that Leo Frank's partisans will use academic fraud to convince people he was innocent. These are the people who shaped the orthodox narrative of the case in the halls of academia. It has been well said that the People vs. Leo Frank might be best described as serving two important purposes for Leo Frank partisans. It provides an up-to-date media regurgitation for reinforcing the well-established Frankite narrative of the case, and it makes a well-presented attempt at being a successful proselytizing propaganda video for recruiting new adherents to that narrative. The Journal of American History published a peer review by Matthew H. Bernstein in June 2010, acknowledging the film's craft while noting the inherent complexity of the case. That review, however, does not engage with the primary source discrepancies Cohen and others identified. A peer review of a documentary that does not consult the trial record it claims to draw from is not a sufficient scholarly validation. 8. The 1986 Pardon, What the Film Does Not Say. The film references the 1986 posthumous pardon granted by the Georgia State Board of Pardons and Paroles. The pardon's controlling language is the most important thing about it. The pardon was granted without attempting to address the question of guilt or innocence. The board did not find Frank innocent. It did not vacate the jury's verdict. It granted a humanitarian recognition that Frank had been denied due process by virtue of his lynching before his appeals were exhausted. These are legally distinct conclusions. The pardon language itself, as recorded by the board, explicitly declined to address guilt or innocence. A film that presents the pardon in an oversimplified fashion at its very end as part of a narrative arc toward historical vindication, without foregrounding this limiting language, misleads its audience about what the pardon actually accomplished legally. Ikes, What the Film Does Well. Intellectual honesty requires acknowledging the film's genuine competences. The cast is led by Seth Gilliam from The Wire as Jim Conley and Will Janowitz, who bore a remarkable physical resemblance to the historical Leo Frank. The dramatic reenactments are restrained by docudrama standards. The film makes no concession to the squeamish. On the morning of the murder, Conley defecated in the elevator shaft, an act that proves crucial in attempting to undermine the timeline in his testimony. What the documentary doesn't tell you is that Leo Frank was so nervous that he stopped the elevator too soon and actually tripped, suggesting he might not have gone down all the way and crushed the excrement in the elevator shaft. Parroting the intended narrative, the video librarian described the film as a compelling look at a troubling case marked by intolerance and injustice. The Library Journal similarly recommended it for all audiences. These positive assessments reflect the film's surface competence. The problem is not that it is poorly made. The docudrama is reasonably well produced at face value when one does not look beneath the surface. The problem is that its evidentiary omissions are systematic, not incidental. X. Conclusion. The People vs. Leo Frank is a professionally produced documentary, but it does not live up to the standard of fairness and neutrality implied by its first opening credits. Funded in significant part by a Jewish advocacy organization with a declared institutional position on the case, built around a predetermined conclusion reflected in its own promotional wire copy, and staffed with expert commentators who speak with striking ideological uniformity, the film systematically omits forensic evidence, Frank's documented trial admissions, the appellate history, and his own racial accusations against black workers. What remains is not an even-handed educational work, but an advocacy production dressed in the appearance of public educational programming. This is the very modern definition of agitprop and propaganda. The docudrama omits the supermajority of the prosecution and defense testimony from witnesses during examination and contradicts the actual exhibits and evidence at the Leo Frank trial that show the defendant committed an assault, sexual violation, and strangulation murder. The Leo Frank trial brief of evidence provides all of the testimony, evidence, and exhibits that were presented to duly convict Leo Frank. The NEH logo on the opening frame does not change that official legal record. It makes it worse because it lends federal credibility to a work that does not hold up against the primary sources it claims to represent. The case of Mary Fagan deserves what this film does not provide. An honest primary source grounded examination of every piece of evidence, tested against the documentary record, without advocacy funding, without predetermined conclusions, and without the systematic suppression of evidence that contradicts a preferred outcome. Critical reviews in Link's compendium. The following is a comprehensive listing of all significant critical reviews and sources consulted in this analysis, including direct links. Negative and primary source critical reviews. 1. Cohen M., 2012, September 3rd. Did Leo Frank confess? The American Mercury. 2. Cohen M., 2012. Review of Steve Oney's In the Dead Shall Rise, Who Really Solved the Mary Fagan Murder Case? The American Mercury. TheAmericanMercury.org, 2012-10, Who Really Solved the Mary Fagan Murder Case? 3. Leo Frank Case Archive, 2011. Leo Frank Documentary and Film Review, People v. Leo Frank, leofrank.org. 4. Amazon Customer Review, 2013. Detailed Primary Source Comparison Review, censored. 5. Internet Archive, 2020. People v. Leo M. Frank, Docudrama Description and Review. 6. Rotten Tomatoes User Reviews. 7. IMDb User Reviews. 8. The American Mercury, Leo Frank Epic Saga. 9. The American Mercury Audiobook Series, Positive and Mainstream Reviews. 10. CBS News, 2009, Film Feature. 11. Daugherty T., 2009, History News Network Review. 12. Video Librarian Review. 13. Library Journal Review. 14. Bernstein, M.H., 2010, Journal of American History Peer Review. 15. Letterboxd, Primary Research and Family Record. 16. Fagan Keen, M., 2024, Updated 2025. Chapter 19, PBS Documentary, MaryFagan.org. 17. Oney S., 2013, The People vs. Leo Frank, Atlanta Magazine, Leo Frank Research Library.